source of temptation. Keep healthy snacks readily available at home, at work, and even in the car. Carrots and hummus, celery and nut butter, a piece of fruit or some olives. One of my patients used to take boiled eggs into work, which she would eat any time she felt peckish. Remove artificial sweeteners. You need to retrain your taste buds, and artificial sweeteners will sabotage that process by maintaining your damaged sense of what sweetness really is. Include some protein in every meal. Meat, fish, eggs, nuts, and/or seeds. Protein keeps you feeling full for longer, which helps avoid sugar cravings. Be prepared. Get into the habit of keeping emergency snacks with you. When traveling, I will take with me a can of wild salmon and some nuts and seeds, which help me to resist temptation when out, hungry, and surrounded by sweet scents and alluring packets. Once you have reset your relationship with sugar, you can begin to consume it intentionally. Take back control of your taste buds and tune into your body's innate signals. If you want that sticky bun, enjoy it, but have it once in a while and no more. Just ensure that you eat it with a conscious knowledge that you're having sugar. Don't assume that your ready-to-eat chicken or supermarket whole wheat bread is healthy. Look on the pack and see what's in it. Strategies when craving. For those times when you do crave a sweet treat, try one of these alternatives. Drink 2 large glasses of water. Some find sparkling water especially helpful. Do some deep breathing, such as 3-4-5 breathing. Distract yourself with a complex task that focuses your attention elsewhere. Have a piece of fruit. Eat a handful of nuts. If you're really struggling, have a small portion of 90%, ideally 100%, dark chocolate. 2. A new definition of 5 a day. Aim to eat at least 5 portions of vegetables every day, ideally of 5 different colors. The UK government recommends eating 5 pieces of fruit and vegetables every single day. They allow fruit juice and smoothies as part of this, which I think is crazy. Given what we've just learned about sugar and the fact that most juices are essentially liquid sugar, I believe this allowance is bizarre. I prefer a different kind of 5 a day that involves eating 5 different types of vegetables. I'm always highly conscious of the skepticism many people feel when I pull this one out. They think this kind of intervention is somehow soft medicine. But, once again, it's based on hard science. It affects your body's biology in just the same way that a packet of pills you'd collect at a pharmacy might. My focus on vegetables alone doesn't mean I'm anti-fruit. I just find that, in an effort to get up their fruit and vegetable intake, most of my patients end up concentrating on super sweet fruit. My food recommendations are intended partly to retune your palate. This approach will help you do that. But why different vegetables of different colors? One of the reasons is that this variety is good for the bugs that live in our gut and their associated genes, collectively known as our microbiome. Scientists have only recently begun focusing on this area, and it's becoming clear that the importance to our mental and physical health of having a healthy microbiome can hardly be overstated. And we have a lot of these bugs to feed. One 2014 paper found the human gut contains between 30 trillion and 400 trillion microorganisms, whereas the number of actual human cells in our bodies ranges from 5 trillion to 724 trillion. Based upon these approximations, write the scientists, the human body could have nearly the same amount of cells as microbes, or at the more extreme end, non-human cells may outnumber our own almost 100 to 1. However, the really impressive numbers are found in the difference between the number of human genes we have compared with the number of microbial genes. In this case, we are outnumbered by between 100 and 1,000 to 1. Microbiome diversity. The incredible complexity of our microbiome might mean that, in some cases, there are more non-human cells in our bodies than actual human ones. While researchers are discovering more about these bugs every day, there is still much that's unclear, not least what represents an ideal microbiome. Initially, the focus was on individual species of bugs to see which the good bugs were and which the bad. Eventually, we realized this approach was almost certainly oversimplistic. Our best guess at the moment is that an ideal microbiome is a diverse one, capable of adaptation and job share. These bugs have evolved with us over millions of years and live off the food we take in and, in return, provide a huge array of services to the human machine. For example, one species makes serotonin, which is the hormone linked with your mood. Others manufacture vitamins. Think of your own gut bug community as like staff in your factory that are producing the products you need to stay alive. That staff are made up of different specialists in different sections who are all expert in their own areas. To maintain optimal health, we need to ensure that all departments are adequately staffed, but we also need to make sure our teams are proportionate, that we have the right numbers of the right bugs, and that no one team is over or understaffed. This is where we have a problem. Over the years, our gut populations have been decimated by modern industrial living, food additives, high stress levels, the overuse of antibiotics, and much more. We know this because studies have been carried out on populations that are still living largely as we once did. By peering inside their guts, we can get a decent idea of what our microbiomes may once have looked like. Studies on Native American populations suggest that those of us living in an industrialized society have lost at least a third of our gastrointestinal organisms. A recent examination of the Hadza, a Tanzanian hunter-gatherer tribe, suggested that the Western gut's microbiome is 50% less diverse than theirs. Whatever the figure, it seems clear we have much less diversity than we used to, and this is likely to be a key factor in our growing rates of chronic, degenerative disease. If we have a greatly diminished microbiome, it might also explain why we are no longer able to tolerate certain foods. This could also be a significant factor in the increasing amount of allergies and intolerances we're seeing. Currently, the UK scores in the top three countries in the world for the onset of allergies. Hay fever diagnoses have tripled over the last 20 years, while hospital admissions for allergies have increased by 500%. It may not only be the food or the pollen that's the problem, but also the fact that the makeup of our microbiome has changed, and with it, our capacity for environmental tolerance has declined. To extend the metaphor, if a healthy microbiome has fully staffed departments all busily working on different functions, an unhealthy one has departments that have been shut down or are understaffed, so not working effectively. Our microbiome represents a key component of our body's defense system against the outside world. The food we eat and its effect on our gut bugs is intimately linked with the activity of our body's immune system, all the more so as the majority of our immune system is found in and around the gut. The fact that this critical component of our defense system has deteriorated at the same time that the quality of our food has reduced has, I believe, resulted in a perfect storm which may explain these rising numbers. Feeding your microbiome. There is a simple way we can start fixing our damaged microbiomes. We are forever being told that vegetables are good for us, but it's not often explained why. Well, here's one of the key reasons. Because our gut bugs love plant-based fiber. This is also known as prebiotic fiber. Broccoli is a particularly fine example. When the fiber that's in broccoli gets as far as your large bowel or colon, it finds itself in the place where the vast majority of your gut bugs live. They feast on it and produce various byproducts, including short-chain fatty acids, or SCFAs. These SCFAs, including the most studied one, butyrate, are anti-inflammatory. This means that they help bring down the inflammation whose harmful effects, including heart disease, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, we first heard about in the Relax Pillar when discussing the importance of me time and communal meal times. This is just a tiny part of that picture, and it hopefully shows why simply thinking about diet in terms of calories, carbs, and fat is so limiting. foods for your gut bugs. Our ancestors ate between 50 and 150 grams of complex fiber per day. That is about 10 times the amount that most people eat today. These complex fibers are known as microbiota-accessible carbohydrates, MACs, because they are carbohydrates that feed our gut bugs. They're found in abundance in vegetables, but also in fruits and legumes. We can't use them directly, as they are hard to break down and digest, but our gut bugs can. A recent study by experts from Stanford University found that because modern Western diet is relatively low in MACs, we don't generate as many SCFAs as we should. These SCFAs are very important for many different healthy responses in the body, including reducing unwanted inflammation. Every time you feel you can't eat any more vegetables, think about those little friends inside you. To feed yourself well, you need to feed your gut bugs well. Although we still have a lot to learn about our gut bugs, there does appear to be one that almost certainly warrants the status of good. Akkermansia mucinophila. Abundant studies show that the presence of this bug is associated with better weight control, insulin sensitivity, and much more. Obese people tend to have less Akkermansia mucinophila than lean people. If we don't have enough of it, we are at greater risk of becoming obese or diabetic. Remarkably, after weight loss surgery, people's Akkermansia mucinophila levels increase. While it's very hard to tease out cause and effect, it does appear that there is a compelling link between this particular gut bug and maintaining a healthy weight. The gut has a protective lining of mucus that Akkermansia mucinophila feeds on, but it also feeds on onions, garlic, leeks, artichokes, yams, agave, bananas, Brussels sprouts, okra, cauliflower, broccoli, chicory root. Akkermansia mucinophila adores these foods and will expand its numbers if fed accordingly. Fasting also leads to an increase in Akkermansia mucinophila, which is the subject of the next intervention. Building up your immune system. Because the body is so interconnected, by feeding the microbiome, we're also strengthening other parts of it, such as our immune system. It's common to think of the immune system as something that is there simply to protect us from airborne bacteria and viruses and prevent coughs and colds. While that's true, 70% of our immune system activity takes place in and around our gut. This makes perfect sense, of course, because our gut is one of the key interfaces between the external world and our bodies. According to one study, there are actually more immune reactions in your gut over the course of one day than in the rest of your body in your entire lifetime. This seems extraordinary, until you remember that everything you put in your mouth is a foreign body. Specialized cells living in and around the gut lining use microscopic antennae to sample our food and check everything that passes through it. This information gathering, along with other signals, allows the immune system to make an active decision whether to let it in willingly or whether to react against it. If it reacts against it, the responses all involve the generation of inflammation, and we can suffer myriad symptoms, such as skin rashes, mood problems, and joint pain. This happens because the system has become unruly and hypersensitive. You can think of the immune system as an army that's there to protect you from malevolent invaders. In a country that's in chaos, the army is out of control, overreacting and attacking everyone and everything. This is chronic inflammation. Eating certain foods can trigger the sending out of chemicals called cytokines that act as messengers, transmitting signals to the system that our bodies are under attack. But eating the right kind of foods can help bring that army back under control. It can give order and discipline, making it more likely to attack only enemy targets with a proportionate level of force. Remember how good we said broccoli was as a means of feeding our microbiome? It also has a beneficial impact on our immune system. Before it even reaches the colon, where the gut bugs live, it arrives in the small intestine. On your small intestine, you've got a kind of lock that will only take a particular key. This lock is called the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, or AHR. Certain vegetables especially the cruciferous ones, such as cauliflower, broccoli, cabbage, have the correct key for the AHR lock. Bits of that broccoli will go into that AHR lock. When this happens, we get rewarded with a proliferation of what are called intraepithelial lymphocytes. These are fantastic because they discipline your immune system. They calm it down, soothing the inflammation, helping ensure that it only responds when it needs to. Our gut bugs and our immune system are not separate things operating in their own sectioned-off zones. They have a deep, powerful, and historical interrelationship. There's even interplay between the composition of your gut bugs and the diet choices you make. That sounds incredible, I know. But your gut bugs can change your mood, and these mood changes influence whether you're going to reach for the healthy salad or the super sweet pastry. Eating different foods also affects your gut bugs in such a way that they alter our body's signaling processes, including how hungry you feel. In these ways, and more, these trillions of bacteria that live inside you are taking over your thoughts and influencing your actions every day. It seems profoundly creepy, I know, but remember it works both ways. We can control our gut bugs and help them work for us with our food choices. Eating the rainbow. When you start eating differently, your microbiome will start changing within 2 to 3 days. Getting 5 different vegetables into your diet every single day will accelerate the process of optimizing your microbiome. To enhance the benefits even further, try to make these vegetables as many different colors as you can. This means it's much more likely that you will encourage the growth of more beneficial bacteria, as well as getting maximum gut bug diversity. But that's not the only benefit. The more colors we eat, the more variety we'll be getting of these incredible compounds that are known as phytonutrients. Many people don't like to eat their vegetables, and vegetables themselves don't like to be eaten. Plants generate various compounds, called phytonutrients, to defend themselves against consumption. These defense molecules, when eaten by us, can have a remarkable impact on our health. There are literally thousands of them, and we're only just beginning to understand their many benefits. They include many different types, such as the polyphenols found in olives, as well as the glucosinolates found in cruciferous vegetables, such as broccoli, cauliflower, kale, turnips, Brussels sprouts, and cabbage. We already know that phytonutrients help heart health, fight cancer cells, reduce inflammation, and reverse brain aging. Different colors contain different phytonutrients. Red foods, such as tomatoes, contain lycopene, which some researchers argue reduces the risk of some types of cancer and heart disease. Orange foods, such as carrots, contain beta-carotene, which has a beneficial effect on our immune system and promotes healthy vision. Green vegetables, such as broccoli, contain chlorophyll, which seems to help control hunger. The phytonutrients found in bitter foods, such as kale, help us feel full. The list goes on. You even find polyphenols, a particular type of phytonutrient, in delightful products like red wine, coffee, and high-quality chocolate. But that's not an excuse to binge. Polyphenols. Polyphenols are a special class of phytonutrients. There are many different types of polyphenol, including lignans from flax seeds, flavonoids found in dark chocolate and red wine, catechins found in tea, and anthocyanins found in broccoli and berries. We're only just beginning to learn about the many different health benefits they confer. So far, we do know that polyphenols have powerful antioxidant effects. Oxidation is a normal process that occurs in the body as a byproduct of various physiological functions. If the antioxidant balance is disrupted, the result in our bodies can very simplistically be likened to rusting on a car. Polyphenols help to dampen down this rusting process and prevent it from causing damage to our bodies. Other health benefits may include lower inflammation, slower aging, reduced blood pressure, improved brain health, improved blood sugar control, improved cardiovascular health, healthier microbiome, improved immune function. Vegetables. One of the best ways to increase the amount of polyphenols in your diet is by eating brightly colored, fiber-rich vegetables. The best sauces are spinach, broccoli, red onions, asparagus, red lettuce, shallots, carrots, artichokes, and both green and black olives. Polyphenols are typically found in higher concentrations in the skin of fruit and vegetables, so peeling them can remove a large amount. Berries. Berries are worth a special mention, as they are jam-packed full of polyphenols. I actually highly recommend berries to my patients, in addition to 5 vegetables per day, because of their high polyphenol content. Their bright colors also make it easier for you to eat the rainbow. Other sources. Some of the best sources include dark chocolate, coffee, and nuts, such as pecans and hazelnuts. The polyphenols found in black and green tea can inhibit the growth of many problematic gut bugs. You can also up your intake with a liberal use of herbs, especially rosemary, thyme, and peppermint, and by using copious amounts of extra virgin olive oil. How to increase your colors. Use the rainbow chart in your PDF to help increase the number of colors you consume. My focus with this intervention is primarily to encourage you to eat 5 different vegetables per day. If you can, make them different colors too. So much the better. I have included some non-vegetable items in the chart, such as blueberries, nuts, lentils, and black rice, because of their established health benefits. My hope is that these additional items will help to make your diet more colorful. Here are some practical tips to help increase your vegetable intake and variety. Print out the rainbow chart from drchatterjee.com and put it on your fridge. Check off all the colors you have consumed in one day. Involve friends, family, or work colleagues to help you stay motivated. Get in the habit of snacking on vegetables, carrots with hummus, cucumber with tahini, and celery sticks with almond butter are some tasty options. Avocados and olives make a quick and easy snack. Although technically fruits, in culinary circles they are treated as vegetables. I consider them to be foods that can be included as part of your new 5-a-day. Leave colorful, appealing vegetables on the kitchen counter or your desk so that you see them regularly. Bright orange carrots, slices of red and yellow peppers, green olives. Add 2 vegetables to every meal, including breakfast. If you're having eggs in the morning, try adding spinach and avocado. A tip that I use with my children is to serve them their vegetables first. Only when they have eaten them will I dish out the rest of the meal. This works for adults too. Roast a whole baking tray of colorful vegetables drizzled with olive oil. Eat some with your evening meal and save leftovers in the fridge. They can form the basis of lunch the next day. 3. Introduce daily microfasts. Get into the habit of eating all of your food within a 12-hour time window. Humans evolved during periods of regular feast and famine. Our bodies are designed for going without food for certain periods of time. But the modern environment, in which we're surrounded by temptations to eat, be they social pressures, via advertising, or the simple fact we have that delicious half-eaten tub of ice cream sitting in our freezer, means we tend to inundate our systems. As soon as you start to give your body a break from all the gorging, incredible things start to happen. An extraordinary health-promoting cascade effect is triggered. After 6 to 8 hours, the liver will have used up its internal fuel stores in the form of glycogen, and soon after this, the body will start to burn its own fat. Once we get to about 12 hours, a process called autophagy will have well and truly kicked in. Autophagy is another hot area of new research that I wasn't taught about in medical school. Much of what we know about it is thanks to the Japanese biologist Yoshinori Osumi, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work into its mechanisms. Imagine that you never spent time cleaning up your house. You'd leave dirty plates hanging around for weeks, stinky clothes on the floor, kids' toys everywhere, laundry baskets overflowing, the sinks machine-gunned with toothpaste splats. This is basically what happens in the body, every day, as a byproduct of it going about its daily functions. The scientific term for this is oxidative damage. It's actually a little bit like the rust that builds up on cars. This buildup is an inevitable consequence of function, and it's all fine as long as we give our body a chance to clean up. This is what autophagy does. Think of it as your built-in Cinderella. It's your body sorting out its mess and busying itself with cellular repair, immune system repair, and a host of other essential maintenance projects. Eating all your food in a restricted time window, for example within 12 hours, allows your body to enhance its own natural house cleaning. Being such a new area of science, there's still limited data on human studies into exactly how and why time-restricted feeding, TRF, assists our repair processes. However, one likely mechanism that's been proposed is that when we don't eat for several hours, the liver stops secreting glucose into the bloodstream and instead uses it to repair cell damage. The liver is simultaneously stimulated to release enzymes that break down stored fat and cholesterol. Therefore, during our fasting period, the liver is helping to repair our bodies and burn off fat. And these are by no means the only benefits of restricting our hours of eating. An incredible American neurologist, Dr. Del Bredesen, has actually managed to reverse memory loss in early Alzheimer's patients by taking a multi-pronged approach that has, as an essential component, regular 12-hour fasts. Yet more compelling research is coming out of the lab of Dr. Satchidananda Panda, a biologist at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in San Diego. Dr. Panda is a passionate promoter of the idea that restricting the timing of our food intake may be an extremely effective public health stratagem. He argues that simply trying to eliminate unhealthy foods and restrict calories hasn't really proved successful, so perhaps a limited eating window might work better. If all that wasn't enough, early studies are showing that when animals are given exactly the same diets over varying time periods, the metabolic effects on their body are significantly different. They put on less fat and have larger muscle mass when they are fed over a shorter period. This is hugely exciting. Human trials are underway. So far, the reported benefits are lower levels of inflammation, improved blood sugar control, improved mitochondrial function, improved immune function, enhanced detoxification, TRF improves the elimination of waste products, increased production of Akkermansia muciniphila, improved appetite signaling. It is possible to enhance these benefits by shortening our eating window even further, but I recommend 12 hours, because fasting for longer can be problematic for some. Most patients I see are chronically overstressed. They need more rest and recuperation time, not more time under stress. Although perhaps not truly optimal, 12 hours is both manageable and long enough for most of us to see real benefits. Which 12 hours should you choose? Recently, I experimented by not eating after 7 p.m. I found it surprisingly easy. As it turned out, eating later was just habit. Just as feeling hungry later was a habit, mostly based upon the readily available access to food in my house. When I stopped eating during the evenings, I felt more energetic, had better sleep, and was just generally a little lighter in myself. I came to think of that evening craving for food as having a kind of itchy mouth. That's become the way we talk about it in my house now. Am I really hungry, or do I just have an itchy mouth? Mitochondria. Mitochondria are the energy factories of your body. Every cell contains hundreds of thousands of them. They convert fuel in the form of oxygen and food into energy. If we want to reach optimal health, we should try to enhance mitochondrial function in any way we can. Most mitochondria are found in highly active organs, such as the brain and the heart, and in muscle tissue. Mitochondrial function is central to almost every single physiological process in the body. Poor mitochondrial function can result in low energy level, brain fog, pain, poor memory, premature aging. As mitochondria produce energy, reactive oxygen species, ROS, are formed. These cause oxidation, which is a bit like rusting on a car. In order to mop these potentially harmful reactive oxygen species up, our bodies need to produce sufficient antioxidants from the fruit and vegetables in our diet. Small amounts of these ROS are helpful, but too many cause problems. When mitochondria don't function optimally, the increase in ROS is known as increased oxidative stress. In the short or medium term, This can contribute to the symptoms listed above, such as fatigue and poor memory. Over the long term, this leads to chronic inflammation, which can be a significant driver of many different diseases in the body, including obesity, type 2 diabetes, and stroke. Eating an anti-inflammatory whole food diet helps provide mitochondria with the correct fuel and necessary repair materials. In addition, the mitochondrial walls are made up of fat, so having healthy sources of natural fat in your diet, such as avocados, olive oil, and oily fish, is important. Mitochondria also need the right fuel, which can be obtained from eating an anti-inflammatory whole food diet. Working with your circadian rhythm. Although the science in this area is still in its infancy, human studies are already hinting that scheduling an earlier evening meal, or skipping it completely, may be more beneficial than not having breakfast. This appears to be because certain bodily functions shut down and don't function optimally in the evening. Intuitively, this makes a lot of sense, but in the scientific world, this is actually quite surprising. Isn't a body like a machine? As in, it either works or it doesn't? Why should one bit of it work better at a certain time of day? I find it incredibly exciting that much of our biological machinery actually has its own daily cycle, not dissimilar to the one that makes us feel sleepy or alert at different points of the day. Even if we're not deeply familiar with the science of the circadian rhythm, how the body floods with melatonin to make us drowsy and cortisol to wake us up, we'll certainly be aware of its effects. It's now becoming clear that our bodies work on any number of these kinds of routine cycles. Last year, I was on my way to a conference in San Diego, and on the plane from Manchester to Heathrow, I happened to find myself sitting next to Andrew Loudon, a professor of animal biology from the University of Manchester. We started chatting, and before I knew it, we'd landed. We both had some time to wait before our next flight, so continued the conversation over coffee. As I sipped at my short black Americano, I mentioned I was traveling to a conference on sleep cycles, and I started talking to him about body clocks. "Well, yes, I actually study body clocks," he chuckled. "And it's not all about sleep, you know. Did you know that if you take a bunch of human liver cells and put them in a test tube, they start operating by daily rhythms?" I found this extraordinary. Andrew told me that all of our bodily functions are determined by a circadian rhythm. This made me wonder if one potentially major failing of many health and nutrition studies might be that they haven't accounted for this. When I looked into it, I found some fascinating recent research to suggest that certain pharmaceutical drugs could work better at different times of the day. Certain genes are also more or less active at various points. Even the composition of our gut microbiome changes with the hours. Interestingly enough, traditional Chinese medicine has been making this kind of observation for thousands of years. They've long believed that various organs have increased function at certain times of the day. All this explains why it's a good idea to start your time-restricted feeding window earlier. Hunter-gatherers tended to do their work either in the morning or at twilight. Have our bodies kept this ancient programming, and could this be one of the reasons that gene activity, for example, peaks at these times? I don't think we know the exact answer to this question yet, but it seems logical. If you ask me, we're not meant to be eating just before we're about to go to bed. We've evolved to eat in the light. Indeed, researchers in Scandinavia found that, in some people, when the body is preparing to sleep and we're feeling tired, the pancreas stops making insulin. You can't override that. Today, we're eating out of sync with our natural rhythms. Time-restricted feeding helps us readjust and give the body what it's expecting at the time it's expecting it. This helps it make the most efficient use of the fuel we swallow. 6 tips to help you microfast. 1. Choose a 12-hour period that suits your lifestyle. Note that your 12-hour eating window is from the beginning of your first meal to the end of your last meal. 2. Your body likes rhythm, so try and keep to the same times every day, even on the weekends. Occasionally, you may need to change your eating window. This is absolutely fine. 3. Outside your eating window, stick to water, herbal tea, or black tea and coffee. Be careful with caffeine so you don't adversely affect your sleep. 4. Try to involve other members of your household or even work colleagues. This will help to keep you motivated and increase your chances of success. 5. Don't be disheartened if you miss a day or even two. It really doesn't matter. When you feel ready, try again and see how you get on. 6. When you are feeling comfortable with 12 hours, you may choose to experiment with shorter eating windows on different days. If you do this, pay attention to how the change makes you feel and adjust accordingly. 4. Drink more water. Aim to drink 8 small glasses, approximately 1.2 liters, of water per day. Do you feel tired or regularly experience low-grade and long-lasting headaches? Often when worried patients come in complaining of symptoms such as these, it turns out that many of them are simply not drinking enough water. Now, the idea we should be drinking 8 glasses of water a day has been around for many years, but, interestingly enough, there's not actually that much science to support it. That doesn't mean I'm not going to recommend it, however. What should I do as a practicing doctor? Wait for the evidence to come from academia that frankly may never arrive? Or should I make a sensible recommendation that I've seen help thousands of patients? I choose to help patients now. This is the big difference between researchers and clinicians. Researchers assess evidence, but it can be a long time before such evidence gets translated into mainstream clinical practice. Some say about 30 years. In addition, some concepts never get properly examined, sometimes because they're hard to study, but often because there's simply no financial imperative to do so. I always remember my chat with the inspiring Olympic strength coach, Charles Poliquin. If you wait for the evidence, you may miss 3 Olympic cycles, he told me. That idea has resonated with me ever since. About 60% of the body is made up of water, and we can only last a few days without it. Water helps us digest food and process substances such as alcohol. Losing just 2% of body weight in fluid can actually reduce our physical and mental performance by up to 25%. I've seen a host of different ailments clear up when people start drinking more water, including headaches, low energy levels, dry skin, and stomachache. It can even be helpful for constipation. If you're feeling tired and sluggish in the afternoon, it could simply be that you are slightly dehydrated. I've experienced this myself on many occasions, not least while writing this book. Don't drink your calories. As someone who abides by the Hippocratic Oath, one of my first criteria with any recommendation I make is, how much harm can it do? The only potential downside to this one is maybe a couple more trips to the bathroom, but that's it. And even that helps you increase your daily activity level, which I chalk up as a benefit. In addition, drinking more water will hopefully mean you start drinking less of the sweetened stuff, such as juices and soft drinks. Fluid bypasses normal satiety mechanisms in the body and allows us to consume a lot more energy and calories than would be possible if we were eating. Think about oranges as an example. A glass of orange juice could easily have 6 or 7 oranges in it. It's perfectly possible to drink a whole glass in one go, whereas it's very difficult to eat 6 or 7 oranges at a sitting. Whole oranges also contain fiber that slows the release of sugar into the body. Juicing removes that beneficial fiber. And don't think you can necessarily get around this by sticking to diet drinks. A correlation has been found between zero-calorie soft drinks and disorders such as diabetes. While the science isn't able to say definitively that drinking these products causes these problems, it certainly remains a distinct possibility. There are several plausible mechanisms we know of that could explain how this might happen. One theory has it that diet drinks contain chemicals that can have an adverse impact on the gut microbiome. As we've already learned, our microbiome health is critical for good health. While we're waiting for the science to catch up, I'd advocate not taking the risk and cutting out diet drinks too. A patient of mine named Annabelle had been suffering from headaches for years and had tried many different medications unsuccessfully. These headaches didn't really follow any pattern, and she was getting extremely frustrated by them. When I first met her, I got the sense that she wasn't drinking enough water. I asked her to aim for 8 small glasses per day. In less than a week, her headaches completely vanished. An added bonus was that she had more energy as well. Again, I must stress that I'm aware of no study that points to 8 glasses as being optimal. It's simply impossible for me to state with accuracy what your individual requirements are. It depends on so many variables, including the kind of job you have, the physical size of your body, and even the climate in which you live. But in my years of clinical experience, I've found that 8 small glasses seems to be about right for most people most of the time. A simple rule of thumb is to look at your urine. You're aiming for a color that is light yellow to clear. Many people, my father-in-law included, find it extremely difficult to get anywhere near 8 glasses of water per day. For people like him, I've come up with some simple strategies. First thing in the morning, drink 2 glasses. If you'd prefer some flavor in it, try squeezing some lemon in there. Before you've even started filling up with breakfast, you're already 2 glasses down. Another helpful strategy is to add in a glass of water 30 minutes before each meal. There is some evidence suggesting that drinking water 30 minutes before meals may reduce the amount of calories you consume. Then, if you start feeling hunger pangs in the middle of the morning or mid-afternoon, try having a couple of glasses of water instead between meals. If you implement some of the following strategies, you should be well on your way in no time. Tips to help you increase your water intake. Have 2 glasses of water when you wake up each morning. If you're hungry, mid-morning or mid-afternoon, try having a glass of water instead of a snack. Once every hour, get up from your desk and go to the water cooler. Drink a glass of water 30 minutes before each meal. Set an alarm 3 times per day to remind you to have a drink. Try adding lemon or orange slices for flavor. Buy a 20-ounce water bottle. We're aiming for 1.2 liters per day, so try to have finished one by lunch and one by dinner. Health benefits you may experience from drinking more water. Fewer headaches. Increased energy levels. Better bowel function. Clearer skin. Fewer stomach aches. Longer periods of concentration. Reduced cravings for sugar. 5. Unprocess your diet. Try to avoid food products that contain more than 5 ingredients. There's no need to count calories, portion size, fats, carbs, Weight Watchers points, or anything even remotely like that. Life is complicated enough as it is. Instead, simply focus on avoiding highly processed foods. It's a pretty safe bet that any food product that contains more than 5 ingredients is highly processed. By avoiding these foods, you will, by default, be not only improving your health, but also sidestepping all the endless confusion that exists about diet. All you need to do is remember the number 5. Our ideas about food have become too reductionist. We've been beguiled by powerful diet cults that are desperate to convert us to their passionate belief that they have found the one true diet. Everyone, including me, has been swept up in these debates and harbors their own personal biases about what's good and bad. For years, we were told that the answer lay in counting calories, despite the fact that a healthy avocado contains more than double the calories of a can of Coke. Do they both have the same effect on the body? Of course not. And we know which has more than 5 ingredients. We've also been led to believe that all our dietary problems can be solved by controlling one single component of them, be it fat or carbs. I believe that the major problem is not that we're simply eating too much food. It's actually that we're eating the wrong type of food. Our culinary environment has changed to the point that we are now eating large quantities of low-quality food. I'm convinced that by simply focusing on quality, many of our problems, including obesity and type 2 diabetes, will simply fall away. Low-carb diets. I know that many of you will now be thinking, well, I've lost plenty of weight and become healthier on a low-carb diet. I don't doubt it. Today, of course, there's a burgeoning low-carb movement that's spread across much of the world. By and large, I support many aspects of this movement, but I tend not to use the phrase low carb. I think that we've unfairly demonized fat for nearly 50 years, and I'm worried that we're now making the same mistake with carbs. I also think some of its more inflexible proponents focus too much on how many carbs we eat. For me, it's not about simply the quantity of carbs in our diet. It's about the quality. The reality is that the majority of carbs we're now exposed to in the West, such as bread, pasta, muffins, cakes, and cookies, are refined and ultra-processed. They have become a daily staple. You can't even buy a cup of coffee these days without having to run the gauntlet of tempting treats. The problem is not necessarily that they are carbs. It's that they're poor quality carbs. In the blue zone of Okinawa, Japan, for example, people eat a diet high in healthy carbs and are known for their longevity. The case of the Okinawans is clear and powerful evidence that demonizing carbs in and of themselves is simplistic and misguided. A unique role for low-carb diets. When comparing the diets of populations around the world, we often miss out other important factors that play a critical role in health. Physical activity levels, sleep quality, stress levels, and how much vitamin D they might be getting from being out in the sun every day. These factors all play an important role in determining not only how healthy you are, but also the kind of diet you need to thrive. The Okinawans who do so well on a high-carb diet also get a lot of sunshine and sleep, engage in physical activity, and have a strong sense of community, as well as low levels of stress. As you know by now, good health results from not just a single component, but a combination of many factors that will enable you to reach your own personal threshold. Could it be that in the modern Western world, where so many of us are deficient in sunlight, which gives us vitamin D as well as much more, too sedentary, sleep-deprived, overstressed, and on top of all that, constantly shoveling large amounts of processed carbohydrates down our throats, a low-carb diet serves a particular and unique role? Perhaps it is in this environment where they have their greatest effect. Maybe in Okinawa, they can reach their threshold another way. Low-fat diets. Supporters of the low-carb movement tend to be critics of the low-fat movement. They argue that low-fat didn't work because people replaced fat with carbs. Yet there are many who swear that their health improves when consuming a low-fat diet. Many proponents of this tend to favor foods that are plant-based and low in animal products, if not entirely free from them, such as with vegan diets. I've seen many patients transition from a highly processed Western diet to a low-fat, plant-based diet and do very well. So who's right? Are you confused? Don't be. The bottom line is that if you increase the amount of low-quality foods in your diet, be it fat, carbs, or protein, your health will inevitably suffer. Just remember that highly processed foods, including most of those with more than 5 ingredients, can be extremely damaging to us and can cause any number of health problems via a chain reaction, which will ultimately affect every process in your body. Note, this intervention is about encouraging you to eat more unprocessed whole foods. You are free and actively encouraged to cook a meal yourself that contains more than 5 ingredients. The key is to avoid food products that contain more than 5. Leaky gut. A state of increased intestinal permeability, colloquially known as leaky gut, is something that I am seeing more and more of in my practice. To start this story, I first need to explain some key functions of the digestive system. When you consume food, it travels down an elongated tube called the digestive tract. This tract is separated from our bloodstream by a border. This border is extremely thin, but also extremely well protected. It's made up of tightly packed cells called mucosal cells. When these mucosal cells are stuck together correctly, they form a protective barrier between the outside world and our bloodstream. To actually get through this barrier requires our food to become fully digested into very small particles. Only then does it pass through these tightly packed cells and enter our bloodstream. But there's another line of protection waiting for it there. On the other side of this border sits the immune system. One of the immune system's roles is to test our food and react accordingly. If you're eating the right kinds of foods, this system will be working well and you'll probably have an excellent level of protection. When you're eating poor quality food, the tightly packed mucosal cells that make up your border can become loose and your gut becomes leaky. This means that morsels of food can slip between or through the mucosal cells that make up our barrier and adversely trigger the immune system, which becomes overwhelmed. This makes you vulnerable to ill health. Imagine going through security at an airport. If you walk through the sensor without triggering it, you pick up your stuff on the other side and safely go on your way. But if there's something in your carry-on luggage that the security system is suspicious of, an alarm will sound. You'll have to wait in line while someone rummages through your luggage. It'll likely be stressful and frustrating. Your cortisol will rise, your heart will pound. You might even miss your flight. Ultimately, you'll be let through, but at a cost. This is a bit like the process that's triggered when we eat highly processed food. Alarm signals are triggered in the body. The muffins or burgers get digested, but there's a price to pay. LPS, the menace. Leaky gut can lead to all kinds of other problems, including bloating and heartburn, as well as problems further afield, such as joint pain, skin complaints such as eczema, obesity, and even depression. What's more, if you have a leaky gut, some particularly nasty molecules called lipopolysaccharides, or LPSs, can slip into your system. LPSs are found naturally on the walls of certain kinds of gut bacteria, but they're not supposed to be in our blood. They're actually highly toxic. If you inject LPSs into someone's veins, their blood pressure will plummet and they'll go into a coma. If LPSs slip through your gut barrier, the effects are not quite as dramatic. However, the longer-term impacts can be just as serious. LPSs alarm your immune system, which then sends out inflammatory cytokines throughout the body. This puts your body's built-in security systems on high alert. This consumes vital energy resources and increases your risk of poor health. This ongoing, unresolved inflammation is problematic. In our airport, the sirens would be blaring loudly. Everyone would be getting stopped and searched, and flights would be leaving empty or being cancelled. There would be chaos. In its efforts to protect you, the whole system can run out of control. This helps to explain why the presence of LPSs in our blood has been associated with a wide variety of health problems, ranging from joint pain and obesity to type 2 diabetes, as well as autoimmune conditions, such as rheumatoid arthritis and neurodegenerative conditions such as Alzheimer's. Many of these share chronic inflammation as a common driver. Inflammation. Inflammation is one of the fundamental ways in which we defend and repair ourselves. If you sprain your ankle, it gets hot, swollen, and red. This is acute inflammation, and it helps the area heal. A short while after, when the body has completed its healing, the inflammation is switched off. So far, so good. Inflammation is meant to be a short-lived process that protects us. It becomes problematic when it's long-standing and unresolved. That is what's happening to many of us as a result of our modern lives. Our bodies believe they are constantly under attack. Our lifestyles are sending the body stress signals that trigger the body's defense systems. This is one of the major reasons why our society is so sick. Chronic inflammation is behind the development of many modern degenerative diseases. A brilliant 2013 paper from Australia looked at the link between chronic inflammation and depression. Its authors reviewed a wealth of data that explored how lifestyle problems such as stress, lack of sleep, physical inactivity, and poor diet, as well as gut permeability and smoking, can drive inflammation, which, in turn, can increase the risk of depression. They concluded, most of these factors are plastic and potentially amenable to therapeutic and preventative interventions. In other words, by making the lifestyle interventions I recommend to bring inflammation back down, it looks like, in many cases, we can actually treat depression and other inflammation-driven illnesses. The basic principles are identical to those outlined in this book. Reduce processed food and eat an anti-inflammatory diet. Eat more plant-based fiber to support a healthy and diverse microbiome. Prioritize regular and consistent sleep. Reduce and manage stress, both physical and emotional. Increase your physical activity. The anti-inflammatory diet. The science of inflammation and gut permeability has led me to what I believe is a major new perspective on health and nutrition. I'm convinced the idea of the anti-inflammatory diet is potentially revolutionary. As we know, chronic, ongoing inflammation is a key driver of the epidemic of lifestyle-driven diseases that we're currently in the midst of. I think that damaged fats, such as vegetable oils, which can degrade when heated, as well as the highly refined carbs in our modern diets, are driving much of this inflammation via the immune system. By making sure that you don't consume any food product that contains more than 5 ingredients, you will very probably be following an anti-inflammatory diet. Leptin. And the benefits don't stop there. Another major issue, I'm amazed isn't better known, is that we are, in the West, increasingly resistant to the hormone leptin. It's leptin that helps make us feel full after eating. It is known as the satiety hormone. Leptin signals to the brain that we have sufficient body fat on board, as fat cells release leptin in proportion to their number. The more fat cells we have, the more leptin we produce. If leptin levels are high, the brain reduces our appetite and may also kick in processes that burn more calories. If levels are low, the reverse happens. This is an ancient mechanism that, when working well, keeps our body weight in check. However, like a lot of our innate biological mechanisms, it evolved into an environment very different from the highly processed food environment that we have today. Against this landscape, it has started to malfunction. People struggling with obesity have high levels of leptin in their blood. They should have very little appetite, as their brain should be aware that their body has sufficient body fat. The problem is, the leptin is no longer effective. Their systems have become deaf to its message. They have become resistant to leptin, and therefore vulnerable to overeating. Research is ongoing into the exact mechanisms behind the development of leptin resistance, but eating too much processed food and its subsequent effect on inflammation is thought to be a key factor. As we've just discovered, highly processed food causes leaky gut, which puts the immune system on high alert. When this happens, a protein called SOCS3 is released, which can interfere with the operation of leptin. The result is unhealthy weight gain and all the problems that come with it. Our appetite is controlled by complex biological mechanisms in our brain, and leptin plays a lead role. Leptin resistance is contributing to our collective inability to exercise control over our calories. If leptin signaling is not working well, does it really surprise you that, as a species, we are struggling? The fix for the past 30 or 40 years, which has largely failed to work, is to control how much you eat and count your calories. As you know by now, I don't advise this. It is not that calories are unimportant. It is just that trying to control them in the face of leptin resistance and a 24/7 food environment is very hard. In over 17 years as a doctor, I have never found this approach helpful. I prefer to reset the whole system so that your body controls calories instinctively. Of course, if calorie counting is working for you, I have no desire to change your behavior. Please continue. Anti-inflammatory carbs. As I have said, I don't like to demonize any one macronutrient, be it fat, carbs, sugar, or whatever. Food is much more complex than its isolated parts. Very few foods in nature actually comprise just one macronutrient. The majority are made up of various combinations. Eggs contain fats, protein, and carbs. Even vegetables like kale and broccoli contain carbs as well as protein. So how can you possibly remove one isolated micronutrient from your diet? You can't. I prefer to concentrate instead on the overall value of food, and that includes carbohydrates. In his seminal 2012 paper, Dr. Ian Spreadbury differentiated carbs into two broad types: cellular, which are low-density carbohydrates, and acellular, which are high. High-density acellular carbs are the kind we find most often in modern processed food. They tend to be refined, highly processed, and often derived from grains. Their structure has been altered. Examples include French fries, rice cakes, bagels, and chips. Dr. Spreadbury argues that